Okay, we're starting just a little late. We apologize. So let's go ahead. If the State Board of Education will please come to order, and Ms. Birdsall, if you'd please call the roll.
Board Member Flores.
Here.
Board Member Goff.
Here.
Board Member Masnak.
Here.
Board Member Rankin.
Here.
Board Member Shuffle.
Here.
Board Member Schroeder.
Here.
And Chairman Durham.
Here. Quorum is present. We'll proceed to item three, legislative update. We are on a tight schedule, and I know this. We've had a lot of conversations about this, about the legislative issues. So, Jennifer, you join us and tell us everything we need to know about what's going on across the street.
In 5 minutes or less, right?
Yeah.
Chairman Durham, board members, commissioner, it's lovely to see you all again. I will do my best to get through a lot of material in a short period of time. Perhaps we should start with the bills that your legislative contacts have recommended you take a position on. So I'm just going to dive right into that. The first bill is House Bill 1121. This is titled Performance Evaluation of National Board Certified Teachers. It is sponsored by Representatives Jenny Arndt and Dave Young and Senators Michael Merrifield and Nancy Todd. This bill would allow districts to exempt National Board Certified Teachers from annual performance evaluations for a period of up to 3 years. Your legislative contacts are both recommending an opposed position on this legislation. We didn't really talk ahead of time. Would you all like to, do you want me to try to articulate why you're expressing that, or would you all like to address your colleagues?
You do it faster.
Ms. Goff,
okay. Sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot there. I know it's early. So if I don't get it right, you all correct me. But the conversation we had at our meeting was that while national board certification is certainly a great qualification, it certainly speaks to a teacher's to great teaching, it is not the same as the performance evaluations that are conducted under Senate that are required under Senate Bill 191. And so it's not an appropriate substitute for those. And I think that's the reason why your colleagues think that this proposal is not appropriate.
Any of the committee members wish to add anything to that explanation? Ms. Goff?
Yes. How long? It was only 2 days ago, right? No, not even that long. I don't know when we talked about it. One thing about it is it is specific to National Board Certified Teachers. We do have a certain number of administrators, school principals, other professional professionally certified licensed people in the state. So I'm thinking that as the while the focus is on the teachers, I'm thinking that at some point we can hopefully look at this according to the uniform in a good way, that word is used, sense of the evaluation process and the rubrics and the other criteria that we have set up through 191. That would be, I would say that there needs to be, if we're talking about National Board Certified, we have several professionals in addition to the teachers that would fall under that category. So that was my primary. Hopefully in the future we will address the whole National Board Certified group completely and thoroughly for what they bring to performance and to student achievement. So.
Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And speaking similarly, the one thing that National Board brings is a level of professionalism to the profession. I've seen several states who put together an incentive package when they're out of money. I've worked in some low-income states, and so they'll say licensure, you get a break on licensure, whether it's fees, a reduction in the teacher evaluation process during a certain period, but whether this bill is it or not is not my conversation, but I would love for the state board to be thinking about, as districts stop paying for national board, and it can be it's an expensive, lengthy process, what can we do, though? What arrows can be in our quiver to help incentivize becoming national board certified with the goal that it would be awesome to have a National Board Certified teacher in every single school in Colorado, rural or urban. But I'm very much open to your ideas and would love your opinions.
Yes. Dr. Schroeder, excuse me.
I'm baffled by this bill simply because the teachers who go for National Board Certification demonstrate a commitment to continuous improvement. And to suggest that they wouldn't want the feedback from a colleague and from a principal over someone else doesn't really match the National Board Certified folks that I've known, and we have a lot of them in Boulder, and they really care about their craft, and they would want to have the feedback. This is not a punishment. Evaluation is not a punishment, and that's what this kind of sounds like. And it goes, in my mind, it goes completely contrary to the philosophy that these folks, who don't not only spend a lot of money, they spend an inordinate amount of time to think about and reflect on their craft. And so I agree with incentives, but that's a contrary incentive. That's sort of saying, I don't really respect the kind of professionalism that you've already exhibited by going through all this. And if I'm not mistaken, they renew their certification as well over time. So this is an ongoing commitment?
My understanding is National Board Certification lasts for a period of actually up to 10 years.
Is it that long? Okay.
Now, the bill, again, specifically allows the exemption, allows districts, does not require to exempt them only for a three-year period of time.
Well, the truth is it's just a nick in 191. It's not anything substantive. I'm sorry to be so frank this morning.
How many bills do we have recommendations on?
We have four bills that we have recommendations on.
Okay, well, then why don't we take these one at a time? Is there a motion to oppose? What's the bill number? I'm sorry.
1121.
House Bill 1121. Ms. Masnick moves. It's been seconded by Dr. Scheffel. Is there objection to the adoption of that motion? Anybody wish to be recorded as voting no? Going once, going twice. Okay, that motion's adopted. Board will oppose House Bill 1121.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 1131, Public Education Standards and Assessments. This one is sponsored, the prime sponsor on it is Representative Terry Carver, Republican. The bill does four main things as introduced. As you all know, Colorado has participated as a governing board member in the PARC Consortium. Several years ago, legislation was passed, statute was enacted, that required that participation. In that statute, it ended it after a two-year period of time.
Excuse me, Jennifer, along those lines, you said Terry Carver, a Republican, sponsored this one. Who sponsored the National Board Certified?
That was Representative Jenny Arndt and Dave Young and Senators Merrifield and Todd. All of them are Democrats.
Thank you.
This it's a little bit tricky, but essentially what this bill is doing on this topic is just striking through some language that's in statute that is no longer applicable anyway because the time frame for which that language applied has expired. So it's not a substantive change to how our state interacts with PARC at this point. The second thing the bill does is give you all the authority to request from the department a plan to allow for the use of multiple assessments statewide to meet accountability standards. Now, the important caveat in this language is that you all can ask your staff to do that if that is consistent with federal law. At the moment, that would require a change to federal law. So even under the new ESEA, the feds do not allow for multiple statewide assessments to count towards all of these things. So, again, this is kind of future-looking. If federal law were to change, then you all are given some proactive authority to move down that path. As you know, in House Bill 1323 last year, the department was directed to do an RFP to choose the 10th and 11th grade exams. That happened, as you know, I'm sure you've heard a little something about this, that SAT won that RFP. What this language does is simply, it doesn't change anything about the existing decision that's been made, but the next time that has to be made, which under current statute is every 5 years, it gives the board the authority to make that decision as opposed to the department. The final thing the bill does is...
Wait a minute, what? The department didn't make the choice.
Yes, they did.
Yes, they did.
They appointed...
Well, I think I understand. The department did involve stakeholders, and there was a group of people that represented districts in making
that
choice.
The fact that they chose the group rather than the board.
Yes, and okay. I think from a legal perspective, it was the department running the RFP and making the official decision. Of course, they did that with the input of that committee that they put together. Okay. This would statutorily change that so that it's your all's explicit authority to make that decision. Finally, I know you all have had lots of conversations over the last year about waivers and with ESEA, this new pilot program that the feds are allowing and whether or not Colorado will participate in it. This language says that if you all do decide you want to participate and if you are accepted, it gives you the statutory authority to reduce the amount of testing kind of in alignment with whatever that pilot looks like. So if that pilot, if you decide, as you negotiate with the feds, talks about reducing testing, this gives you statutory authority to do that. So those are the four components of the bill. We have a split recommendation from your legislative contacts on this. Dr. Scheffel is recommending a support position, and Jane Goff is recommending a monitor position.
I would recommend oppose.
Okay. All right. So any discussion from the board? Is there a motion on this piece?
Well, let's hear from the board.
Any comments?
Go ahead, Deborah.
I just think there's several features of that I think would be helpful to us. So I recommend that we support.
Okay.
I second that, if it's a vote.
Well, yeah, we'll take a motion in just a second. Ms. Goff, do you wish to?
Well, I'm just in my, it's not necessarily cautious, it's more in a watchful, and depending on what might transpire, possibly before the end of the session, around our federal work, anything around the ESSA and the pilots that are being developed here, if any. So that I'm just monitoring. I agree with... I do agree with the support position in that there are several points in there that need some more discussion. They deserve some more discussion, possibly. But I'm just not ready to say one way or the other where we go with this. I appreciate the fact that the State Board is given some authority in the choice of the exams, but I don't know that that's necessary. I don't know.
Yes, Dr. Flores.
I mean, I think if we're going to be responsible, and we are responsible, then we should take responsibility for something as significant as a test that is going to, that is so important for kids. And I don't know about you all, but I certainly had been listening to people about which one, because I actually thought it might be our decision to make. And so when I read in the paper and from the department that a choice had been made, and then the telephone started ringing, I just was appalled, you know, that we didn't even know that this was even coming down. And I think we have a big stake in that, and we should be responsible for it. Certainly, we go out in the field and ask for opinions, but ultimately it should rest with this body.
Yes.
I just would like to second what Val said.
All right. Is there a motion for on this? Yes, Dr. Scheffel. Pardon me?
I'll make a motion that we support this legislation.
Is there a second to that motion? It's been moved and seconded. Ms. Masnick is a second. Is there objection to the adoption of that motion?
There is.
Would you please call the roll, Ms. Burson?
Board Member Flores?
Yes.
Board Member Goff?
No.
Board Member Masenek?
Yes.
Board Member Rankin?
Yes.
Board Member Scheffel?
Yes.
Board Member Schroeder?
No.
And Chairman Durham?
Yes. That motion is adopted on a vote of 5-2. So, Jennifer, as you talk to people about that bill, just make sure to note the vote on that, okay? So that they know it's not unanimous.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you.
The next bill for consideration is Senate Bill 45. This is in addition to the financial literacy standards. So in current statute, statute is much more directive in the area of financial literacy standards than it is in other standards in our state. So, but that's the status quo. This bill doesn't create that. What it does do is add to that rather directive standard language in statute a specific requirement that that our K-12 system educate students about college loan and student loan debt and those financial issues. So it's taking an existing rather specific directive, making it even more specific. Your legislative contacts have the same recommendation on this one, and that is to oppose. They can obviously speak for themselves, but our discussion was that this is a level of minutia that is unnecessary in statute, that the statute already allows and could be read even as encouraging schools to do this, and this just doesn't seem necessary.
And to do what? I'm sorry.
Well, the statute already says that in the financial literacy standard you have to talk about debt and all of that. So, you know, there's nothing prohibiting schools from talking about student loan debt right now, and if they're implementing the financial literacy standard, I bet they are at some level. So I think, and again, I'm just trying to characterize the discussion. My opinion doesn't really matter. So that's your recommendation.
Yes, Dr. Flores.
But I think that bill also discusses life skills, such as just debt in general, and you know, credit cards and all that.
Dr. Flores, that's the existing statute, yes. So you're right, that the right now the statute says you have to do life skills and credit card debt and debt and all of that, right.
Okay.
So this just adds a little
more motion.
Yes, is there a discussion and or a motion on this? Yes.
I would move to oppose.
Okay, it's been moved. Is there a second?
Yes.
Second to Dr. Schroeder. All right, is there objection to the adoption of that motion to oppose? Seeing none, that motion is adopted unanimously. Ms. Mel?
Thank you. Okay, so we're on our last bill to, in terms of consideration of positions. This is Senate Bill 72, which would increase the annual lease purchase payment cap. Leach, I don't know. That's interesting. You know, I will confess to you all that I know nothing about bonds and the bonding market, and for some reason this session I have had to deal with multiple bills on this topic. So I called Leanne last night. She helped me make sure I understood this bill, and I'll do my very, very best to explain it to you. Right now there is a statutory cap of $40 million. That's the maximum amount the state can spend on COP payments annually. Those COPs essentially are, you know, it's debt that we enter into in order to deal with school capital construction and maintenance issues. This bill increases that cap over time.
Jennifer, on a district-by-district basis? Is that what this is? There's a cap at the district level that you can only...
Madam Vice Chair, actually this is referring just to the state cap. So districts do also participate in some of the bonding.
State?
Mm-hmm. Under the BEST program.
Well, this is under the BEST program. Because districts have COPs on their own, right?
Absolutely. And this does
not... That's not where we are.
Correct. This is specific to the BEST program that is in statute right now. So essentially, that's what we're saying is we could... the BEST board would be able to incur additional debt through certificates of participation in order to build more, construct more, fix more, and they have a well-established existing process for how they prioritize all of that. As I confessed early, not a financial expert, I am assured that people who are financial experts believe that the revenue source through the State Land Board and the other revenues that come into this program are sufficient to allow for that higher level of annual debt repayment. So, you know, the experts that be think that there's enough money there.
Ms. Masnick.
So I'm not a financial person either. This may be a question for Ms. M. I just want to say the divine Ms. M every time I refer to you.
I would agree with that. I would make a motion and second.
Could you explain what COPS are? Are COPS, aren't they...
not the kind that stops you on the road.
Right, I understand that. But as I understand it, they're a way to provide funds without taxpayer approval. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr.
Please
Chair.
Proceed.
Certificates of participation are a debt instrument that when you raise, the repayment can be made out of general funds and any sources of funds that are available to an entity. Whereas if you enter into a bond issue, typically you are doing bonds and seek mill levies in order to create the funds to repay that debt.
But the voters don't vote on this.
Not necessarily, right? On certificates of participation.
Not necessarily? Sometimes they do?
I have seen times where potentially a district or another entity will do a mill levy override in order, and that may be one of the sources of revenue that is used to pay certificates of participation back or something like that. But typically, they do not increase, they issue certificates of participation because they are lease obligation. The other thing that goes along with those lease obligations is that they are always subject to appropriation. So that if a taxing entity entered into a certificate of participation, they must put that clause in there that it's on an annual renewal basis, subject to appropriation. Therefore, the entity could potentially default on those COPs if they chose, if there was not enough appropriation or available resources. And that has happened, actually, in the city of Sheridan. That happened back in the 90s.
So the other component of this bill that I think is relevant for your discussion is when it was in its first Senate committee. It's passed out of two Senate committees at this point and is on its way to the Senate floor. But it was amended to the status quo is that charter schools must wait 5 years before they can apply to the BEST program for funding. This removed that. So now charter schools could apply in the first year of their existence for BEST grants. Now, again, there's a process that the BEST board goes through to approve and prioritize all that, so it's not a guarantee of anybody getting money. But at least it allows any charter school to apply when they see fit. So that's the basics of the bill. You have a unanimous from your two ledge contacts, a unanimous group of two have recommended that you support this bill.
Okay. Do we have any further discussion? Is there a motion on, what's the bill number? Yes.
72.
I would like to just add something. is there any specification within the bill that states that the buildings, if they are bought by a charter school company or whatever, that school stays within the common good of the state or the district?
Dr. Flores, no, I don't believe this bill addresses that issue. I would defer to Leanne M. to see if there's other existing statute or best policies that address that issue.
Right now, the statutes do require that the buildings are either owned by a district or that the charter school owns them. So right now there's no provision to allow a private owner of a building that the charter school is renting from or something like that, that the they could not seek a grant to improve that private-owned property. So that it, right now, the way I understand it, and I'm not the expert on this, but that the buildings either have to be owned by the state, the district, or the charter school in order to be eligible for the grant.
But if it's owned by the charter school, isn't that a private? Isn't that private?
No, charter schools are public.
Charter schools are public. I don't know. They're 501c3, so they're a private entity.
They're run by 501c3s.
Okay, so but
owned.
If there is money to fix that building, then it becomes a common good. It becomes the state. In other words, I don't think it's fair for the public to be paying monies on schools, even fixing them, if they're not going to stay within the domain of the state and or the district.
I think that's what you're saying, isn't it? That they have to be district owned before they can.
That the charter school
they don't have access to those
the district,
funds.
So that the charter school can apply to the program
to rent or to fix, but it stays within the domain of the state and the district. I mean, that's I'm asking a very. I think because I don't think we want to spend monies for public monies to give to private entities. That's my concern.
And the charter schools being either part of the charter schools are authorized by the district, so they are a school within the district. And the fund, all of the taxpayer funds that go to the district are also supporting that charter school. And so the BEST program can either support charter schools or the neighborhood schools. I'll call them the neighborhood schools within the district. But they're all supported with public funds.
Right. And they're owned by the public, by the
correct.
District or the state.
Yes, correct.
So
I would like to hear from the legislative liaisons
Dr.
about
Shevel,
their
you
support.
Comment quickly.
Yeah, I guess I tried to do a little more research even after we met, and I feel a bit more equivocal at this time than I did at the time when we met about whether or not we should support it or monitor it, and it's just because there's a lot of nuances and some of them had changed a bit since we met. Is that right?
No, actually, the bill had been amended, as I've described it to you, before you met. And it's probably good to say that part of our procedures, our policies, are that if you've taken a position on a bill and then that bill changes significantly, I will bring that back to you as the ledge contacts, and you can then, you may want to recommend a change of position or not, but that is absolutely part of my job, is to make sure that if you've, you know, to use 1121, for example, that you guys have just decided to oppose, if that bill changes a whole bunch, we're going to talk about that again. We don't just let that ride.
I didn't know if the chairman had any thoughts on it, since you're at the legislature. If you have, I mean, I tried to understand the nuances, and I understand it to some degree, but
It's an existing program that's being expanded. I think the answer to Dr. Flores' question is these remain public, essentially
funds.
Public property.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So it's an expansion of an existing program, and whether you like COPs or not is, you know, may drive part of how you might view the legislation.
And so, the tax implications that Pam Mazanek alluded to, is that?
That's the COP, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the debt instrument.
Right.
It is not, they are not subject to voter approval. You know, they can, some districts would probably vote on them, but because they're a contingent liability, not for more than 1 year, and can in fact be turned back to the bondholders. As opposed to general obligation debt, they're exempt from essentially the provisions of Tabor. They predate Tabor. They go back to 1981. I could give you a long, sordid history, but I would have to admit many of my past mistakes to do that. So they go back a long time, and they predate Tabor, and they're exempt from Tabor because of the mechanism they use. Yes, Dr. Schroeder?
So I'm just remembering all the lectures that we had from Marcia Nail about this, the land school land trust fund. Are there any provisions in there that make sure that comes out of income as opposed to out of principal? I'm just trying to channel what I thought I learned and what the concerns were about totally depleting that fund.
The way the way the statute would is current, the way the bill reads now, is that the land board still is obligated to transfer 50% of their revenues over to the BEST program. Mm-hmm. So if they were to earn $100 million in any given year,
it's 50.
$50 million. There's no provision in this current bill to increase that 50%
Okay, so the decisions
like that
have been made historically, whether one agrees with them or not,
still remain
by the land board. Continue, and they're the ones who decide what goes forward. So they're the ones to get mad at if we don't think they're doing
correct.
Or some people get mad at, not me.
Yeah, okay. I don't believe you can constitutionally expend the corpus, only
correct.
The interest.
Correct.
Yeah, and Marsh's argument was about the, what do you call those front-end lease payments that people
lease
could
purchase.
Lease yeah, purchase. The bonuses that are paid at the very beginning. Are they really income?
Oh, I.
It was an interesting discussion, yeah. Not all of which I totally understood, but I think...
Part of this debate might be moot because that fund is dependent on royalties largely from energy, so there's been a significant decline
Sayonara.
In those anyway.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay.
Further
okay.
discussion, is there a motion? Ms. Rankin?
I just wanted to ask Leanne the question about if we go from $40 million, it just raises it to $60 million, correct?
Correct, over a period of 5 years.
Okay.
So
who is ultimately held to that?
The state would, if, for instance, there was no revenues coming in from the state land board or anything like that, then the state would be under obligation for that repayment.
My concern at this point is where our budget is now in our state, and because of limits to it, I don't know if I want to put the state at risk like that, and that's a concern of mine. But at this point, because of the questions that are raised and the understanding we have, or lack thereof, I don't know if this is the way you make the motion on it, but I really would recommend a monitor on this one.
It's been moved and seconded now that we monitor this piece of legislation. What's the number, 17, did you say, Senate Bill?
It's Senate Bill 72.
Senate Bill 72. All right, is there objection to the motion to just simply monitor Senate Bill 72? Seeing none, that motion is declared adopted. We have one more bill, is that right?
We do not have any more legislation to take a position on. We had a couple of other things on the agenda that I could run through just very quickly because I know I'm over my time.
Right, and the Lieutenant Governor is waiting, so can you give it to us in about a minute?
Well, I
hate to
certainly,
keep the Lieutenant Governor waiting.
I know, boy, that's
he's a patient
pressure
man,
there.
We don't want to test it.
He's catching up on his note-taking.
okay, so and you all know that you can all call or email me if you have questions about this. So just a reminder that the Joint Education and Joint Budget Committee School Finance Study meetings are continuing. We sent you that information last week. The speaker has been announced for Wednesday, February 17th, and that is Andrew Rostchowski, PhD.
Could you spell that?
I can't necessarily say it, but I have it in writing here. The topic being how the local property tax supports and distorts the statewide school finance system. So that sounds interesting. At your direction, I continue to work on data privacy. At some point, we actually will have a bill with specifics to talk about. At your direction, I am also working on legislation to, right now, when you all grant waivers to innovation schools, those exist in perpetuity. You've asked me to get some legislation moving that would put a time limit on that. Representatives Patterson and Senator Hill have agreed to carry that and help us with that, and Representative Patterson assured me last night that the paperwork would would get the final okay today, because I told her I wanted to be able to tell you all that, so that helped. And then finally, there are two concurrent enrollment bills out there. I know you guys care a lot about concurrent enrollment. One of them is on third reading in the House today. It's the one that requires high schools to notify parents and students if the course that they're enrolling in is not transferable. So that bill is moving fairly quickly through the system. The second bill on that is House Bill 1128 by Representative Paul Lundeen. That bill will undergo significant changes from its introduced version, and so I think perhaps the best course of action is for me to bring, once those amendments are made public and that's processed, we'll talk about it at our Ledge Contact meeting, and then we can work it up through our process.
Yes, Ms. Ringen.
If someone's interested in listening to those education meetings with finance, can they link auditorily through that, through the CDE?
What an excellent question.
Thank you.
I actually don't know the answer to that. You know,
so
most
let me
hearings,
fill you in.
Oh, please. Okay. I don't. How about that? My response be, I don't know. What do you know?
I'm sorry. I thought you might know.
Busy looks like it might involve her.
No, it is not on CDE, but it is on ledge.state.co.us,
okay.
And they're also archived, so if someone is interested in that and misses it, they're all online.
So the one we missed already, we could go back and
absolutely.
Listen.
Absolutely.
And if you'd like, we'll send you the link.
That?
Yes,
that
yes. So Megan Wagner, who works in our firm, I'll have her send you all an email with that link for future and for past.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Miller. Oh, yes.
On that, I know they're considered public meetings, mm-hmm. but is the participants are really the legislators and the leaders. I mean, is there a certain kind of understanding about who's in the room to participate?
It's stakeholder meeting, and I have to say, Jane, I thought the same way you did. I thought I would go in there and everybody be up front and I'd be the only, well, and of course, Ms. Mello would be out there too. And the room was full.
Sure.
And so people are interested, people are coming in and of all types. And so I think the more we get that out, mm-hmm. that you can hear it online, the more, and I have gotten that out to my district.
They're absolutely open to the public. They're conducted with kind of the normal legislative committee process in terms of questions and all of that. So you've got the legislators kind of sitting kind of where you all are sitting right now in that setting. But I also want to really emphasize that the legislators who have really been spearheading this have very, very consciously and insistently reached out to the department and to the board and really want to be partners with you all in all of this. So I hope there's no sense of exclusion. And if so, then you can blame me for not communicating it properly. But there absolutely is a willingness and a desire to have this be, they want your perspective and they want your involvement.
Well, I guess my question is a picture of the situation. Is it like a town hall? The public has been asking me, can we go and...
So they're not. They have not set one up for public comment at this point. At this point, they have been... So kind of like I'm sitting here presenting to you all. The legislators are up on their dais, and they have a speaker who's been presenting to them. Now, future meeting, the agenda hasn't been determined for all of the meetings, and I wouldn't be surprised if one of them becomes open for public comment, but I can't give you a guarantee of that at this point.
Why don't we, if we can, Dr. Fursley, we are late, and we're keeping the Lieutenant Governor late, so we can perhaps revisit this at the next meeting, Ms. Mello.
Of course.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Let's welcome Lieutenant Governor Garcia, and we apologize for the delay and hope it doesn't upset your schedule too much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have to get to another event, a literacy event out at a school out in Lakewood, so I'll try to move pretty quickly. I do appreciate, as always, the time that you give me to come and talk to you about what the administration is working on, as well as what Department of Higher Education is working on. I also want to take this opportunity to tell you how much we're looking forward to working with Commissioner Crandall. And we've already met with him and his senior staff, and things are going very well. We're trying to continue that open communication between the department and the administration and this department going forward as we had previously. So thank you and welcome, Commissioner. And also want to thank Commissioner Asp, the interim commissioner, for all of his service to CDE, to Department of Higher Ed, to all the students in the state, really to the entire Colorado education community. So we really appreciate what he has done in terms of working with us. I want to mention a couple of things quickly. One is that I want to reiterate a point you all heard the governor's mention of the state of the state about testing. We do know that last year we had bipartisan legislation that resulted in a reduction in testing by about 30 hours in order to support additional instructional time. And that is a reasonable approach. We certainly understand the need to not over-test, the need not to to avoid taking away too much instructional time. On the other hand, you also heard the governor emphasize his support going forward for continued ninth grade assessments, that we really think those are critical as we try to balance the need for instructional time, the opportunity for local teachers and building administrators and local school boards to make decisions, but we also recognize that we need to measure the progress of our students at some point in some consistent way so that we can ensure that all kids from all school districts, all zip codes, all backgrounds have the opportunity to get a very good education. We also want you to know that we are continuing to work at the Department of Higher Ed on closing the attainment gap and supporting post-secondary student success. And so we have been working at the department and with the commission in certain initiatives that do impact your students. One is around prior learning assessments. We want to make sure, as we think about how we ensure that students move through the post-secondary system and earn a credential and do it without taking on too much cost, that they get credit for what they already know. One of the things that's been very helpful over the years, of course, is the IB tests, the IB courses and tests, and the AP courses and tests that so many secondary students take. But, as you know, that not all institutions of higher education give credit to those students based on the same cut score. So we've been working with all of our institutions, and we have, at the most recent Commission on Higher Education meeting, approved an AP cut score of a 3 and an IB score of a 4 on really all of our GT Pathways courses. And the goal here, again, is to make sure that students know when they take these tests, they take these courses, they put in the effort, that they are going to get credit if they go to a public institution in Colorado. And this is particularly important, again, as we want to ensure that we move students through their post-secondary career more quickly. We have one of the things that most drives costs and debt is when students can't graduate in 4 years, and sometimes often take 5 or 6. So we want to address that. The goal here is simply consistency and transparency. We also at the commission meeting approved the post-secondary workforce readiness definition, and that is that, quote, Colorado high school graduates demonstrate the knowledge and skills, competencies needed to succeed in post-secondary settings and to advance in career pathways as lifelong learners and contributing citizens. And we think that's useful to us and to the institutions of higher education as we look to expand our work regarding workforce readiness. You all are very focused on post-secondary readiness. We are as well, but we want to make sure that, again, as students come into the post-secondary environment, whether it's into an educational setting or into the workforce, that those students are well prepared. We also just completed our educator preparation report. And this year, our report highlights some of the concerns that we know you share. In fact, they impact you dramatically. And that is, we have a teacher shortage. And we know that it impacts certain parts of our state much more dramatically than others. And the bad news is that when we look at the students enrolled in our colleges and universities in teacher prep programs, it's down 6% this year and 23% compared to where we were 5 years ago. That has an incredible impact, especially on our rural schools. So we're going to continue to work with this department, with the BOCES groups, alternative providers, and our institutions of higher education to help remedy the situation, but it's going to remain an area of significant concern for all of us. We also just released our talent pipeline report, and that is to help us understand as a state whether we are producing enough graduates in the right areas to meet our workforce needs. What we saw very clearly is an extension of the attainment gap we see in higher education, because it impacts not just our institutions and those students, but our employers. And so we're seeing in our business and industry areas, very low numbers of students of color, graduates of color, whether African-American or Latino or Native American, available to fill jobs in healthcare, IT, and business and finance. We need to get more of our students enrolled more in those programs and more graduating. And the report went on to identify 20 core skills that are necessary for Colorado's workforce. Some of these are a little harder to assess than others, and certainly not all of our students are coming out with the skills in critical thinking and creativity and self-direction and time management, self-advocacy. Those are things that are important not just to students, but of course to employees and employers. So last, I want to just mention very quickly, I want to lay to rest any concern. I know some folks have raised it with us about a possible switch or an eventual switch from using the ACT as the standard to the SAT, whether that's going to do anything to our higher education institutions. And I want to be very clear that our institutions of higher education have long accepted both, of course, of those assessments, because we have students applying at our universities and colleges from all around the country. So the use of SAT and ACT are both specifically addressed in our remedial policy and in our admissions policy. And so we don't view it in any way as disruptive of anything that we are doing in higher education. And that's my report, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Questions of the Lieutenant Governor or comments? Getting off easy today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the time.
Thank you very much for coming. We appreciate it.